I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. We're all familiar with the following. Outgoing single male seeks adventurous female for a possible romance, but did you know we owe the personal ad to the straight-laced Victorians? Today we talk with a professor about romance and marriage during that era and examine some other dating and marital traditions started by the Brits, including the surprising thought that love should be considered part of the deal. Later on this hour, we zoom forward 100 years and talk about the impact of technology on love. Kansas City native Molly Shapiro tells us about the pros and cons and ups and downs of online dating. Needless to say, we'd like to hear your stories about all this, too. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Today, a look at courtship old and new. We'll begin with a look at courtship in the Victorian era. Who knew that so many of our modern-day traditions, such as taking honeymoon trips or wearing a white wedding dress, or even that love should be part of the equation, came from the Victorian era? Then we'll turn to high-tech courtship circa 2012 through the lens of a new novel that looks at the pros and cons and ups and downs of online dating and social networking. The author Molly Shapiro of Kansas City learned firsthand about this new world after going through her own divorce a few years ago. The good news? This, in some ways, strange new way of meeting members of the opposite sex actually worked for her. But first, some background on where some of our dating traditions came from. Our guest is Jennifer Fegley. She's author of Courtship and Marriage in Victorian England and co-chair of the English department here at UMKC. And Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice
Thanks
to have
for
you.
Having me.
Well, you've based your career on the study of the Victorian era, which encompasses much of the 1800s. Why the Victorian era? What's been the draw for you, Jennifer?
Well, actually, when I began graduate school, I thought I wanted to study the modernist period. I was obsessed with Virginia Woolf. but when I was reading Virginia Woolf's novel To the Lighthouse, which was my favorite of her novels, I really became interested in the Victorian period. That novel is really basically an elegy to the Victorian era.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured out that what I was more interested in was that age prior to the modernist period.
Would you have liked to have lived there back then?
That's an interesting question. No.
As a matter of fact.
No.
I'm interested, but I don't want to live there. Okay.
One of the things that really fascinates me about the Victorian period is how resonant I find it with life today.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that it has so many connections. All the issues that we're interested in today, political, social, all of our concerns, to me, I can trace them back to the 19th century. But there are a lot of things today that I wouldn't want to give up. So, no.
Such as what?
Well,
the current modern day convenience.
Exactly.
That you're talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, the social welfare net and protections for women and freedoms that weren't widely available at the time.
So. But still, you think of the Victorian era and you do think of this sort of heightened era of romance and courtship and all of these things, which seem to be something of part of our history now as opposed to something we're still currently engaged with.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of people call the Victorian era the age of the invention of love. So
yes.
It's the beginning of the idea of the companionate marriage, that you're not going to marry for family reasons or only for monetary gain, that marriage isn't a contract between families, isn't necessarily a passing on of a woman from a father to a husband, but that it's something that a woman has a choice in.
And that's one of the great legacies of the whole era, right? That's a whole new way of looking at marriage back then.
Exactly. Around the late 18th turn into the 19th century, you begin to have these new ideals of who you should marry and why. And women had a lot of greater burden then to make a good choice of who to marry. And there were many, many factors that went into it. And, of course, the most famous is romance, love,
mm-hmm.
so that you would be choosing a spouse based on the same reasons we would choose a spouse today.
Well, who was it back then that began championing this idea of love should be part of the equation much more so than it had been before?
Well, that's a really interesting question that's difficult to answer. But one factor that went into it would be a growing middle class, shifting in class status. You have people who are beginning to move up in class status, and you have a lot of movement and expansion mm-hmm. of the middle class. And so you begin to have alliances between old aristocratic landed families and newer money. And in this transition in society, you begin to have an emphasis on choice in marriage. So no longer was it solely linked to family.
And so society, people were a little better off financially. Society was a little more stable. And then suddenly you had a luxury of looking at marriage in a little different way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You also have among the working classes a great migration from rural locales to urban locales. And with that, you have a severing of family ties. So a lot of people are coming to London, for example, to work in factories, to find new opportunities for their trades.
Right.
And when they arrive, they don't have set social groups guided by their families, and they're sort of on their own. So you have a whole culture among the working and lower middle classes that is shifting towards instability and a desire to create a new sense of community, and often that would be done through marriage.
Which is, of course, much the way it is today, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering, when people, as I mentioned, they picture the Victorian era and they think of, extended courtships and all this romance. In fact, is that what it really was? As you examine it as closely as you did, does that image still hold up in your view?
Well, I think the primary image we get is from novels. People think of Jane Austen. Of course, she's pre-Victorian. George Eliot's Middlemarch, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, Dickens' novels. This is where we get our idea of what Victorian courtship it was like. But in my research, I actually found that it's a lot more like courtship today than we imagine. While there were thousands and thousands of conduct books and advice manuals and etiquette guides.
I was amazed by that, going through your book, just how much material there was out there trying to hold the hands of folks, trying to figure all this stuff out.
Yeah, yeah. So there are all these guidebooks about how to do courtship, how to find a spouse. But what I found interesting was that the proliferation of these guides really points to the fact that the rules aren't as set as we imagine when we read the novels. So we read the novels and we think of these elaborate rituals and people following all of these rules. Yet, if everyone knew the rules, what would be the need for these thousands and thousands of self-help guides, basically,
right,
to help people navigate through courtship? So many of the people who were using the guides were people who were trying to rise in class status, so they wanted to imitate the behaviors of those above them. And so what you get is a lot more fluidity in courtship and a lot more divergent practices than what we imagine when we read the novel.
Hmm. How difficult is it for a researcher like yourself to get a hold of those books that are as old now as they are? Someone have those things laying around?
Well, of course, about, 5-6 years ago, you would have to go to London, basically. If you're studying Victorian England, you'd have to go to the British Library. But just as I began working on my project about 3 to 4 years ago, Google Books exploded. And almost all of the conduct books that I use in my book were readily available on Google Books.
That's amazing. Just click the mouse and there you are. That's great. Well, the Victorian era of British history was, of course, this period of Queen Victoria's reign from 1837 until her death in 1901. You point out in your book that her marriage was a tricky one to pull off in terms of, the traditional role reversals and everything else that she was involved in herself. Describe that to us.
Yeah.
I never thought about some of this stuff before.
Yes, I mean, Queen Victoria, obviously the era is named after her. She's the symbolic woman of the period, but she was also the leader. And so there was a difficult negotiation. She wanted to appear to be the perfect mother and wife, the angel of the house, as they called it. Yet, you know, she was really in charge in a way that most women would not be in her relationship. So that created an interesting dynamic.
How could she not be, given who she was to England for all of those years?
Exactly. But she did take efforts to indicate that she was a proper wife.
Yes.
And in some ways subservient to her husband, yet she didn't want to let on that he was making, you know, political decisions.
Yeah.
So there was a fine line there. But if you look at her letters that she wrote, she was very passionate about Prince Albert. And there are some really effusive love descriptions of her love for him and her passion and the way he made her heart beat.
Wow.
And how he covered her in kisses, you know, all of these very romantic notions.
How long have those letters been available?
For a very long time. Now, these, you know, you don't find on Google or anything like that.
Yeah, where did you find them?
Those through the British Library, yeah.
So like,
and the Windsor Castle.
We just did a show, I think, last week on Queen Elizabeth and the very difficult line she has to walk, balancing her public duties with her private duties. And you're saying Queen Elizabeth was very much the same way.
Yes, Queen Victoria.
Victoria,
yeah. Was very much the precursor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking today about Victorian England and a new book by Jennifer Fegley of UMKC. The title of that book, Courtship and Marriage in Victorian England. And you have a chance to go see Jennifer in person. She'll be speaking at 6:30 on Thursday evening at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the branch downtown at 14 West 10th Street. More information is at kclibrary.org or at kcur.org as well. If you want to join our conversation, you always can do it. 816-235-2888. Our email address is uptodate@kcur.org. Well, let's walk through sort of the arc of romantic relationships, Jennifer, and what was different about them then compared to now. How about just sort of social gatherings where people might meet each other for the first time? Same thing we see today, or were they different in some substantial ways?
Well, it's interesting because it depends on your class, your mm-hmm. social class status. So, you know, if you were actually a working class person, you had a lot more freedom to interact with the opposite sex. In fact, there was something among rural couples called bundling, where the families would allow the interested parties, the young woman and the young man, to spend the night together. They would bundle them up together and they would sleep together.
Get out of here. you're shattering my notions of Victorian England here.
Yeah. Yes. Historian John Gillis actually argues that it was advantageous for some in the agricultural laboring classes to actually get pregnant prior to marriage to secure a husband. But there were also
that
cases.
That old trick, it still lingers to this day. Yeah.
Yes. There were also cases where women did not want to get married because their wages would then be, in a sense, handed over to their husband. So there were many single moms. There were women who chose not to marry, especially among the working classes. And there were all kinds of interactions among men, young men and young women who were of the working classes. As you move up the social scale, the interaction is more and more regulated.
And why is that? I mean, it doesn't surprise me. It makes sense to me. But why is that?
Well, I think it's an attempt to preserve the family contractual economic exchange elements of marriage while allowing young women and men to seem to have an open choice. So there was something called the London season among the upper classes, which actually really ran, you know, almost all year, all year round, but about 8 months of the year. And there would be many, many regulated activities for gentlemen and ladies to get together. There were garden parties, picnics, balls, boating excursions, you know, all kinds of organized events which would be chaperoned. So I think the biggest difference between then and now in courtship or dating, as we would call it, would be that for the middle and rising into the upper classes, you would have a lot more supervision of your interactions. But there was a big rebellion against that as well by the end of the century.
I sort of like that bundling idea you were talking about a few minutes ago. We'll go back and talk about that some more later on. Yeah. How about first dates? What would a typical first date be all about?
Well, among the working classes, you might, go for a walk in the park. You might go to the pub. You might go to a museum if you had the day off.
Yeah.
Very similar to what people would do today. In the middle and upper classes, though, again, it would be a more orchestrated situation, and it would usually take place at someone's home or at a public place where a party would be taking place, where, you know, your parents or some other chaperones would be around. So there wouldn't be what we would call an actual date where, you know, couples would go somewhere on their own.
Mm-hmm.
However, Victorians were very clever in sneaking away from their chaperones. So certain events, especially outdoor events, playing croquet, going on boating trips, these were activities that young people adored because they could easily escape the eyes of their chaperones, and they frequently did.
So that's the big difference. It sounds like it's chaperones, right?
Yes.
You're using that word several times here, and that would be kind of awkward, I would think. You know, I'm not sure I like that a whole lot.
Yeah. I mean,
how long did that last?
Through to towards the end of the century. And mm-hmm. by the 1880s and 1890s, you have people beginning to argue that we need much more free and open communication between men and women before they can make appropriate choices mm-hmm. about who to marry. So the idea is, well, if you can never talk to someone alone, then how are you really going to make a good choice? How are you really going to know them? So you begin to have alternative forms of courtship that emerge as a way to, you know, rebel against that structure.
You know, when I was a kid, and they still have this today, I used to go to something like in seventh grade called cotillion. You know, a very formal dance where you had a little dance card. You had to go around and fill it out. And there always would be three or four names already put on your dance card. So you had to dance with that girl at the time. And I used to be just a train wreck, nervous before those things. You know, it's just such a big, you know, it's so different than any experience you were used to up to that point in your life. Suddenly you're doing this very formal thing with adults all around the room watching little Stevie walk around trying to do this thing, you know.
Well, that is very Victorian.
It is very Victorian. Yeah. And they still do that today, I think. Yeah. Okay, moving on. Extended courtship, how would that sort of play out once a man and a woman actually became interested in each other?
Well, the idea was not to allow the engagement to last too long because there were fears of what would happen if there was a falling out. So the ideal was less than a year that you would be engaged.
Wow.
And then you would move on to marriage as quickly as possible before anyone could object.
Really? So it was a rush, the whole thing?
No, I wouldn't say. I mean, they wouldn't advocate rushing, you know, too quickly, you know, within a month or two. But that it was important to plan, and weddings were getting more and more important, bigger, fancier. The dress was becoming more important, the party. So you needed time to prepare mm-hmm. all of that.
How were women and men, for that matter, who chose to remain single, whether they were straight or gay, how did that people react to that in Victorian England?
Old maids and bachelors. There was many ink spilled over the problem of the old maid as well as the problem of the bachelor. So it was considered a social ill to remedy. In the 1851 census, it was discovered that there was a population imbalance between men and women. And the realization struck that not all middle-class women were going to be able to be married. So there were all kinds of schemes to solve this problem.
Like what?
Well, some feminists actually argued that women needed better access to education and professional opportunities, so that they needed to be able to work and support themselves. But a very famous idea of a man named W.R. Gregg, he wrote an article about what he called the redundant woman. And his idea was we need to ship all the women off to the colonies because that's where the men were. They ship them to America, Australia, other colonies.
Put them on a boat in big boxes and see you later, right?
Exactly. He thought it should be government-funded program.
A big bow across the box, probably, too. How far did that idea get?
Oh, not very.
Not very.
There were all kinds of female emigration societies that tried to help fund women to go to the colonies to get married. The interesting thing about Greg, though, was that he didn't want to ship off the servant class women.
Because you needed them to work?
You needed them in the home to make the Victorian family function. But the interesting thing is most of the women who did emigrate for marriage were in the working and lower middle classes. They went, they were governesses, mm-hmm. they were servants, and the hope was they would marry up
wow.
while there.
How were gays regarded?
Oh, this was really not very openly discussed till really the turn of the century. Oscar Wilde, most famously, had a trial, and basically his career was ended once he was sort of outed.
Yeah.
It was pretty much an open secret. I mean, no one really talked a lot about it, but there were many gays and lesbians, a lot of women who actually cohabited. They lived together. And it was really kind of accepted, but nobody talked much about it openly.
Hmm. We were talking before about chaperones, but one writer, Maud Wheeler, in your book, Jennifer writes, she confronted what she felt was hypocrisy in society regarding courtships. She wrote that societal dictates were clear and that if a woman were to regard a man as a friend by walking out alone with him or talking with him without a chaperone is most improper, reprehensible behavior. Wow.
Yes. Yeah. But Wheeler was against that.
She was saying yes.
Yeah. And she was saying that this is something that needed to be remedied. W.T. Stead was a famous journalist at the time who actually ended up going down with the Titanic. he started a matchmaking correspondence club called the Wedding Ring Circle. And his idea was exactly that, to remedy this situation in which men and women were kept too separate. He wanted he invited men and women to write personal advertisements for themselves, describing their attributes and the kind of person they were looking to marry. And then he paired them up in correspondence groups, and they would write letters to each other. And eventually, if they wanted to meet or write personal letters that weren't shared with their whole circle, it was sort of like a pen pal circle. He would, with permission of the parties, he would release their personal addresses and information.
So that's how Match.com got all its
exactly,
its idea, right?
Exactly, exactly. The Wedding Ring Circle. And
we'll talk more about Match.com in our second half today,
exactly.
by the way.
Yeah. So the Victorians were doing it first. And he proclaimed in his magazine, The Review of Reviews, that this was very successful. And he made many love matches and many marriages among sophisticated and educated men and women who wanted to communicate with each other on a more equal footing.
What a concept there, yeah. Now, we began the show by talking about how some of the traditions of the Victorian era apply even today. How about the wedding itself and white dresses, and tell us how all that came to be?
Well, most people actually did not marry in white wedding dresses. Queen Victoria did, and she sort of was iconic in setting this trend. And of course, the wealthier you were, the more likely you were to be able to afford a white dress. Mm-hmm. The problem with the white dress was that it was difficult to reuse.
Now you're speaking to me. I've always wondered about that. What's all this about? Yeah.
Yes. So if you had the white dress, you know, dresses were very expensive. They were custom made. And so most people wore their dresses over and over again. And so to spend all that money on a dress that you couldn't reuse was beyond most people's means. Mm-hmm. But what they would do is they would dye it a different color. They would piece it out, take parts, the top, separate the top from the bottom, put a new top on. So people were getting very crafty. But it really wasn't it became by the end of the century the thing to have a white wedding dress. But throughout most of the century, people typically would wear a gray or a blue, sometimes even red or purple dresses for their weddings.
And marrying in a church was the thing to do or not?
Yes, it definitely was. Yeah. And more throughout the century, people were having civil wedding ceremonies. So things were shifting. But yeah, a church wedding would be typical. You would have a wedding breakfast. It would usually, the wedding would take place in the morning and would be followed by a breakfast.
Between 8 and noon, you wrote in here. 8 and noon?
Yeah.
8 o'clock wedding? I can't imagine.
Yes. So people were drinking really early on those days. Some people complained about, you know, being drunk by 1 and then having to be productive for the rest of the day. But yes.
You have to get up at 3 or 4 in the morning to get ready for your own wedding, which doesn't sound like a lot of fun to me at all.
Yeah. By the 1880s and 90s, as most things were shifting by then, this was too. People began to complain. They began to move weddings to the afternoon and have receptions as we do today.
So by 1900, you're saying that England pretty much came to its senses on a lot of things, right? Am I hearing that right?
Yeah. From our perspective, yes, mm-hmm. yes. So the ways our wedding rituals today were pretty much in place by the 1890s.
That's interesting. Well, Jennifer, I sure enjoyed having you. Thanks for coming in today.
All right. Well, thank you.
Again, you can hear Jennifer Fegley discuss courtship and marriage in Victorian England at 6:30 this Thursday evening at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library downtown at 14 West 10th Street. More information at kclibrary.org. Again, Jennifer's book is Courtship and Marriage in Victorian England.